Oh, good evening. It's really nice to be here with everybody. And so I really hope this is a conversation as much as it can be. So feel free to interrupt or ask questions. I'm happy to talk to you about those. And I certainly have, you know, a presentation that I'll go through with you. But my experience is, particularly teaching in Asheville and to participants from Integrative Family Medicine, is you may have already had experience, maybe quite a bit of experience with meditation or mind-body practices. In fact, maybe just, if you don't mind, raise your hand if you have had some kind of mind-body practice. And yeah, right. Yeah, so almost everybody. Wow, I lost them in less than a minute. No. it's not surprising that hopefully some things I'll be able to share with you might be new to you. And I want to, the reason when they asked me to do this talk, the reason I put hype at the front of it is that I think there's a lot of noise in the world and in our culture today about mindfulness, about what this very simple practice of paying attention in the present moment in a way that is clear and kind can be co-opted, right? Commodified in ways that don't really support the beauty of it, really, you know, the wisdom that's within it. And I will tell you that I teach, as Ariana said, in Buncombe County Schools and the Asheville Fire Department. We're going to be doing a program with the Marine Corps later in the year at the Chapel Hill School of Medicine, the campus here in Asheville. All of these places are secular. Like when I talk to them about mindfulness, I'm not talking about any kind of, and I'll talk about this a little more, but any sort of religion. You don't have to have some belief system. In fact, I make very careful to be sure that what I'm teaching is basically a basic human capacity, right? You don't have to, you know, chant or burn incense or wear robes or something to engage in this capacity. And it's incredibly important because we live in an era of continuous partial attention. So I don't think the owners of Cathay Pacific Airline were too thrilled when they woke up in the morning and saw their $75,000 paint job. And this is just an indication, you know, of a lack of attention. And this one's pretty funny, but it gets a little less funny when you think about the woman who walked off the pier into Lake Michigan because she was texting on her phone and walking at the same time, which would have been quite funny, except that she didn't know how to swim, and her teenage daughter and a friend had to jump in the water and save her. It gets even less funny or even more concerning when you consider that 6,000 Americans are killed every year because they're texting and walking, and often walking into traffic. Or more than 250,000 Americans die every year because of medical administration errors. I teach at the VA. And one of the programs they started, and I can't believe how this ended, but they had the nurses who were giving medications wearing a yellow sash. And basically the message was, stay away from me because I need to be completely focused on what I'm doing. And that program's no longer in place, which is sad, or at least here locally. But my intention tonight is to talk about how this might be pragmatic, how this might apply in your life. And that's really kind of the possibilities aspect. But I also want to talk about the hype first, because I think there is some, and I want to sort of dispel a little bit of that. I want to talk about what it is when I talk about mindfulness. I was trained at UMass Medical School, the Center for Mindfulness, and I'm getting my certification, in the process of getting my certification at Brown University. In mindfulness, and so it's important to understand what we're even talking about, because I think as many of you raised your hands, you might have that many definitions of what mindfulness is, and that's okay, but for the purpose of what I do and where I teach, I need to be really clear on what I'm doing, what are the objectives, what am I trying to teach. Right, so The only way to really apprehend, to understand what mindfulness is to experience it, like to subjectively understand it from the inside out. And so what I'd like to do is to invite you into a practice of actually just arriving, like transitioning in. A Harvard study found that we spend about 50% of our day either ruminating about the past, right? Like thinking about things that we could have done or should have done, or spending time focused on the future, right? If you spend a bunch of time in the past, the mental health correlate to that is depression. If you spend a bunch of time in the future, that's where I go, what's that mental health issue?
Anxiety,
right? Yeah, you're worrying, you're ruminating. And it turns out that when we spend more time actually in the present moment, even when we're doing the crappy jobs like taking the trash out or picking up the dog's poop or washing dishes or whatever, we're actually, our affect, our well-being, our emotion is actually better, right? Because we're actually there. And so what I'd like to do is just a brief arrival practice. It's a chance to transition. You don't have to change any way you're sitting. We're not trying to get to any mountaintops. We're not trying to eradicate all the stress in your life. We're not trying to stop. We're certainly not trying to clear your mind. Good luck with that. Dan Harris from ABC News says, if your mind is clear of thoughts, you're either dead, I'm really sorry, or you're completely enlightened. Congratulations. So what you might want to do, if you want to, is uncross your legs and have your feet flat on the floor. But again, just be comfortable. And then it can also help quiet the nervous system. So we have two subsystems in our nervous systems. One's called the sympathetic nervous system, which is fight flight. You might know that system. And the other one is the parasympathetic. And they work like this. They're reciprocally inhibitory. So one goes up, one goes down. And so to engage that parasympathetic nervous system, the rest, repair, regenerate, is closing your eyes. So if you, because the visual system takes in about 80% of our sensory data. You don't have to. In fact, take really good care of yourself in this whole presentation. Doesn't just include the bathroom, but even if we do a practice, you don't have to close your eyes, or you could stand up if you need to. But if you want to, allow your eyes to close or pick a spot on the floor in front of you, just some neutral spot. And you might begin this practice just by taking one or two slow, deep breaths. And then just allowing the breath to drop into its own natural rhythm. You don't need to focus on it. In fact, you don't need to focus on anything right now. You can just sort of hang out here for a moment. And just recognize you don't have to control the breath. You don't have to actually do anything. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to achieve anything. To actually ease off the accelerator on our typical driven doing mode of mind and functioning. And just maybe offer a little bit of space or a glimmer to being here. Just to settle a bit. As part of this practice of arriving, you may want to take a moment, if it feels right to you, to greet your own self. You may have greeted lots of people today, in the grocery store, at work, even at home, at school. You can bring that same kind of care, that same kind of compassion to your own self. And there are several ways to do this. One way is to simply hold some caring phrase or word in your mind that you silently repeat to yourself. If you're more of a visual person, you might picture a loving friend or family member or some devoted pet, perhaps. Another way is just to maybe ease the muscles of the face and shoulders. Just as a way to bring some gentle friendliness to yourself as you transition to be here now. And then perhaps taking one more slow, deep breath in and out. And on the end of the exhale, allowing your eyes to open. So what'd you notice in that practice? Anything at all?
No
rush to get somewhere or do something else at the time. Yes, somebody said something over here.
It's relaxing.
Right. So often we get going so fast that we miss stuff. Anybody have coffee or tea this morning? Raise your hand. Yeah, quite a few of you. So just reflect back for a moment, and I won't ask for a show of hands or anything, but just reflect back for a moment and think about how much you noticed this morning, you know, of that particular experience, you know, of coffee or tea or whatever it was. And that we can choose at times to be more awake, to be more alive for what shows up in life. And let me just say, back with that practice, that there's not a right answer there. Whatever you experience is what you experience. Now, you know, relaxation may absolutely be a side effect of settling the body and bringing your attention into the present moment. In fact, it's a very common one. Feel calming or settling, feel settled or something. And so just know that whatever's going on is what's going on. And mindfulness doesn't like suppress it or like get lost in a story of it. It's saying, let me just pay attention to what the hell is actually happening in my life. So here's the caution portion of of the talk, of the hype, right? So some of you may have seen this years ago in Time magazine. Wonderful that Time magazine actually put mindfulness on the cover in 2014 or whenever it was. But it does send a little bit of a confusing message that if I don't look like this blissed out, perfect skin, perfect hair, we already know like mindfulness is not going to help you with your hair, right? I mean, we got that. and so while it's nice to have that information, it can make individuals feel like this is what the goal is. And I want to be a quiet, measured voice in our community that says this isn't what it's about. In fact, somebody says that actually what mindfulness looks like is really more of a whip and a chair, like with your mind, because our minds can really be quite erratic and take us into all kinds of rough neighborhoods mentally. But there are a lot of companies who are doing this, but the Harvard Business Review, you know, saying it's a must-have, it puts pressure. And I think this is not what is intended when we think about mindfulness growing organically, right? More from the ground up than some top-down CEO saying, you will be mindful. I've been very grateful for Mission support of the program that I teach at Mission Health is called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. I'll talk a little bit more about that. But one night a couple years ago, I went in to the classroom where I teach, and there was a little postcard and a minute glass, right? And they were in the room, and it said, you know, any meeting that we have at Mission, start with a minute of mindfulness, right? So sort of this idea of mandated mindfulness is not such a great idea. It's much more powerful if we can bring it in from the inside out, bringing it from the inside out. And there are a lot of organizations utilizing it. I mean, I mentioned the U.S. military and professional athletes are using it, anything that can give them an edge. And then I said I teach the medical school and businesses and so forth. So it is out there quite a bit. But I think that I want it to be supported in a way that is sustainable, right? That's going to be here in 20 years. And so my wonderful wife and my daughter are here. And I get the question quite frequently in my classes, you know, do your kids meditate? And I said they all have at times. But I don't never made them do it, at least I hope not. because I want them to have access to it when they're 30 or 40 or 50, when it might be a tool, a helpful way that has some utility in their life, a meaningful component of their life. So what are we talking about? This is an operational definition from UMass Medical School. Mindfulness is the awareness that arises from paying attention on purpose in the present moment non-judgmentally, right? So there's a temporal aspect to this, there's an agency aspect of this, like you have an intention, and then this last word there, non-judgmentally, is a critical component. When you hear the term mindfulness, you want to be thinking heartfulness, right? That it is as much about the domain of emotion and heart and connection to the affective domain of being human as it is about anything cognitive that's going on, or even attentionally. Those things all matter and happen, but the component of non-judgment is really critical. And I mean, my gosh, I don't know about you, but judgment, like I probably had four of them coming from the car into the building here, right? It just is rampant. And a lot of it is, most of it's not a personal flaw. You know, it's just the way our minds are wired, our brains are wired to be constantly vigilant, like be assessing threat everywhere. And we don't have saber-toothed tigers that are going to eat us in this day and age. But our stress response system works the same way, whether it's up here in my head and I perceive it, like that email that I didn't like, you know, or some look that I got at work. My body's going to react in the same way as if I actually am out hiking at Bend Creek and see like a copperhead, right? The same physiological response system is going to be engaged. What mindfulness is, it's as important to talk about what mindfulness isn't. And this is, I think, I really want to be clear on. It's not a quick fix or a panacea. You know, it's like exercise. If you're not sweating in the gym, you're probably cheating. It's not going to happen really fast. You might see benefits, like you might experience changes. I mean, I had people come back after a week in the class and say, wow, that was really powerful, that I actually, you know, could pay attention to my dinner or to my spouse when they were talking to me, or to something at work that might have set me off. But in terms of curing cancer or something is not what mindfulness is about. Emptying or clearing the mind, I've talked about. Good luck with that. I mean, it's, you know, we secrete something like 50,000 thoughts a day. It's not a religion or a relaxation technique, right? I said it might be a byproduct. It might be a side effect of sitting and paying attention. The body might settle. That parasympathetic nervous system might come online more. And if anybody's done it for very long, you find out it's not easy. It's quite simple, but it's not easy. And it's also not escaping, not becoming some zombie. I mean, you know, I had a 20-year business career and was pretty successful in that. And I am very active in what I do now. I work quite a bit. But, you know, being mindful and having a practice, having a meditation practice, hasn't made me, you know, less productive. But I think one of the real game changers in terms of mindfulness is this here. So we get hit with stressors and all kinds of challenges all day long, right? They all happen. And oftentimes, because our brain is an organ of experience, we have reactive patterns. You know, the brain says, oh, well, this is how I'm going to handle it when somebody cuts me off in traffic, right? And I know how my brain used to work in Washington, D.C. I have unlearned some of that. I've extinguished some of that behavior. Not completely, but 80 or 90% for sure. So that I can respond more. But this is a very common kind of a crisis. Anybody like identify with this, right? Something happened, like you get that phone call from mother, you know, it's like, and then the same stimulus can happen, and with mindfulness, with a practice of mindfulness, you build some space in there, right? Between the stimulus and our response is a space. And in that space, says Viktor Frankl, lies our power and freedom to choose. To choose, how do we want to respond to life as opposed to reacting? I mean, we get so jerked around by our emotions and by our thought patterns, by events. And what I say here is that I teach at the fire department, and when we went into the recruit academy originally to talk to them about teaching mindfulness, we didn't go in and say, well, look, you just need to make the recruit academy about 40% nicer, you know, just take out so it's not so stressful for those poor recruits when they come in. I mean, they'd have laughed us out of there in about 3 seconds. The stressors are the same. What shifts with the firefighters is that they understand that there's a mental capacity to this, right? So there's sort of a bottom up, right? Those breath practices, just like I start and finish that arrival practice, take a deep breath in and out and finish with a deep breath in and out. So it's not just the breath practice, it's also coming from the top down and saying, oh, it's like this now. So they have something it'd be pretty awful to have to do it, but it's sort of cool, is they have this something called the entanglement box. And there are wires, thin wires all through this, and they have to crawl through this thing. It's like this and this, and they have to crawl through this thing with their turnout gear on and their SCBA, their tanks, right? And so you can imagine it takes them a long time to get through this thing, and it can be really very stress-induced. I mean, it's triggering that sympathetic nervous system for sure. And what many of them report is this happening. They start to have this reaction, and then they drop down here and say, oh, let me come into my breath, do what's called, we teach them something called four-square breathing or box breathing, and then they can begin to slow down and actually take it one thread, one wire at a time, and move through that. And so if you're a parent, you know, how about the parent entanglement box? Anybody been in one of those? You know, they're not much fun. But I love what one of the younger firefighters said, you know, as firefighters, we get paid to respond to calls, not to react to them. And I think about a medical student who told me there was a patient who was actually quite triggering for them. And they were using this practice, actually stay grounded. In fact, at one point, they didn't feel all that safe. And so you don't want to suppress that. You don't want to pretend or deny something. But they said, I was actually able to stay in the room and actually help this person, to care for this person. So this is changing a lot of how, this is sort of on the, I would say mindfulness is on the forefront of what's called participatory medicine, which has been out for quite a while. And you see this on how medicine is being reimbursed, how healthcare is being reimbursed now, and how it's being organized. There's something called patient-centered medical home, which you may have seen at medical practices if you've been in some westernized medical practices where they're saying, this is how we get reimbursed, right? Not at IFMA, but... and so what they're doing is trying to push the patient, to the center, right? And so, but from a ecological, from a healthcare model, don't we want to be at the center? Now, it doesn't mean I'm a cardiologist and I can know how to take care of my heart, but it says I'm at the center, and then to have some awareness about what is going on inside my own body, inside my own skin, can be really important and helpful. And this is Duke's. This happens to be Duke Integrative Medicine's Wheel of Health. The research in mindfulness has really exploded in the past 15 years particularly. It's probably up around 7,000 studies now on mindfulness. There's probably more than 12 on meditation, but just with mindfulness. And about 15% of these are what are called randomized controlled trials. And all of these, the thousands of them, have appeared in peer-reviewed journals. And of these, about 15% are randomized controlled trials, what I would call the gold standard of academic research. And of those, the ones I really pay attention to are the 300 to 400 that have appeared in what I call A-level journals. These are like the Journal of the American Medical Association, the British Medical Journal Lancet, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. These are the most rigorous scientific journals in the world. And what this says to me as a clinician, and to perhaps you, is that there's now a growing body of science that says something important is going on when we train the mind. Something important is happening in terms of utilizing these practices to become healthier, to heal, to become well. So I want to talk about a couple of these in a minute, but let me just say that mindfulness as a practice is a single lever. You're pushing on one lever that has, at least the research indicates, that it has effects on multiple domains of being human. So for example, attention. It helps with the efficiency of the brain, how the brain attends, and we know attention is the workhorse system for all cognitive function. And so if we can make the brain more efficient in how we attend, that's really important. And let me also say that that attention is a gift. It's a gift that we give each other. And it's something that we can withhold. And sometimes we're really active and, you know, we know we're withholding attention. Other times we're withholding attention because, right, we've got a phone and somebody's really trying to say something to us. We did a practice at the medical school yesterday, and I had the medical students break up into pairs, and so we did a reflection practice on something skillful that they'd done in clinic in the last 2 weeks. So they came up with some story. I said, fill it in. Who was there? What time of day was it? You know, what were you thinking? What was going on? What were the emotions around it? Really try to fill in the color, the narrative itself. And I said, okay, so now one of you are pick up your cell phone, and now the other person, while the other person tells you that story, you need to send a text or an email, but you have to be writing while you're doing it. And so one of the students reported, he was on the phone and he said, I realized I had like 30% of my attention here on my phone, 30% there, and he said, I'm not sure where the other 40% went. And he said, which is not surprising, but anyway. But I think one of the most wonderful, I think, byproducts of doing a practice like this is being able to direct and sustain your attention, to recognize what is signal, like what do we want to pay attention to, and what's noise. And there is a crap load of noise in our life. And I think if you actually slow down and looked and said, man, a lot of stuff that I consider signal, I'm paying attention to it, I'm dealing with it, maybe in an involuntary way, is a lot of noise. Cognition, behavior, I probably won't get to talk about that. There's research on smoking cessation and nutritional changes and so forth. Physiology, the brain actually changes. A couple studies out of Harvard found a reduction in gray matter density in an area called the amygdala, which is, it measures salience. It's not the stress center, but it measures salience and so forth. And then another area in the limbic system called the hippocampus is where we is associated with learning and memory. And those, the gray matter there actually grew, so changes. I will talk about some physiology on a study with MBSR and breast cancer. In relationships, emotion, so being able to moderate emotion. I've taught in middle schools, and what the students who are practicing report is that they're able to actually self-regulate, to actually get a little more regulation, to take a little break from the torrent of emotions that go on. I mean, do you remember middle school? Do you remember what that's like? A little bit of kindness would go a long way. So let's just do another practice. Let's bring your feet to the floor, maybe flat on the floor. And if you have something in your hands, maybe put that on the floor if you would. And you can sit in a way. Yes, yeah, you want to? Sure. Okay. And just sit in a way. Yeah, come on. You can come on through. It's okay. That's okay. And just sitting in a way that feels dignified and relaxed. And again, you can have your eyes open. In fact, let's begin with your eyes open. So maybe finding a neutral spot, but holding a wide visual field. So your gaze might be focused on one place, but you have what's called situational awareness. Noticing perhaps colors, shadows, light. Geometry of shapes. And for the rest of this practice, you could stay focused on the visual field. But if you feel comfortable with it, allowing your eyes to gently close. And perhaps bringing awareness to sound. And knowing that at any time you can open your eyes if you want to check things out and close them again. And if the invitation, the guidance is to let sound be at center stage, just notice if other things push their way into the center of your attention. A thought, a body sensation, an emotion. And just as best you can, coming back to sound. When the mind wanders, that's not a defeat. That doesn't mean you're a bad mindfulness practitioner. It means you're a normal human being with an attention system that is vigilant and moves around. And you also have this human capacity to redirect it back to sound. Sound of my voice. Noticing if sounds are intermittent or constant. And then can you be aware of the air that's bringing the sound to your ears? The temperature, perhaps movement of the air. And then if it feels right to you, perhaps noticing the air that you're breathing. Feeling the sensations of the movement of the air. Perhaps in and out of the nostrils or the expansion and deflation of the chest and lungs. No need to control your breath, no need to change it. Just to feel your breath moving in and out. It can help to perhaps make a silent mental note to yourself. When you're actually feeling the physical sensations of the breath, not thinking about the breath, but actually feeling the breath in the nostrils, in the chest, belly. Just silently saying the word breath. And if anything else comes into your field of awareness onto center stage, just name it as not breath or other, or name what it is, thought, emotion, sound. And then returning as you're ready to the breath. It's not about perfecting anything. It's just about practicing being here now in a particular way with clarity and some kindness. And then broadening your attention, almost as if you're turning the aperture on a camera, widening your awareness to the whole body sitting here. Just a sense of how it is with you right now. What's it like inside of your own body? The energy in the body, is it stirred up or calm, agitated or settled? And no need to fix it or change it, just to be attuned to your own self. And even if with your eyes closed, perhaps widening beyond the envelope of the skin to yourself sitting here. Even with your eyes closed, you probably have some sense, what's called proprioception, of your body in this chair, in this space. And then as you're ready, you can take one slow, deep breath in and out. And on the exhale, allowing your eyes to open. And just seeing if for a moment you can maintain that thread of continuity, of presence, of being here, just for a moment. So what was that experience like? What did you notice in that practice? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So giving yourself some time, some care. And what might be a benefit of that? Like taking care of yourself a little bit. Yep. You can take care of others better. Wow. That was unprompted. Thank you, Lauren. Yeah, right. We can't really take authentic care of others if we're a mess, right? I mean, and you can certainly check it out for yourself. We might put on a show we might do a lot of caring, giving, but actually to show up to really be there. What else? What else did you notice in that practice?
Better focus.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just.
Yeah. How might that be beneficial in life? You won't miss the F when you're painting Cathay Pacific's airplane, right? Right. And so whatever the code blue is in your life, right? I mean, because we have them at home or feel like they come up at home and in the grocery store, on driving. So I'm going to talk about a couple studies. Because I think it does help to know that this is out there, and I certainly encourage you to get on Google Scholar and check out these kinds of studies or different ones if there's particular conditions that are an interest to you. This was published this year, actually it was published in August, a study of mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is an 8-week program, about 2.5 hours per week, plus home practices of about 30 to 45 minutes. These women were early diagnosed with breast cancer, and they looked at a number of factors, both psychometric measures of things like sleep disturbance, perceived stress, anxiety, depression. All those scores improved, not only during the 8 weeks of the intervention, but at time 6, which was 6 months after the intervention. Right, so they were maintained. Sleep disturbance was not. That was not maintained. The benefit there was not maintained. And then they looked at domains of mindfulness, which you might expect improve, things like observing, which we've already done in these two practices, describing, just like you may have done in that mental noting practice or portion of that practice, if you heard that during the guidance. Non-reactivity to inner experience, non-judgment of inner experience. I mean, might that be useful as a patient, as a human being, to like not get so fixated? I mean, and I'll tell you, for me personally, I was doing it this week, right? Having a lot of judgment and not so much reactivity, a tiny bit, but you know, but having that, that's part of it. You know, and look, man, I've been doing this for a long time. It's not that it goes away, but can I turn the needle, can I turn the volume down just a little bit, right? 10%, 15%, that could be really helpful. So these women found that to be beneficial as well. But the thing I think that is really remarkable and that we're seeing in more and more of these clinical trials of these mind-body interventions are what are called biometric measures. So what they found in these women is that over the course of the eight-week protocol, and then these were sustained through, all of these were sustained through 6 months, a reduction in something called interleukin-6, which is a cytokine. It's a protein that we produce that creates inflammation in the body. Those went down. So this isn't someone saying, you know, hey, that guy, that mindfulness teacher was pretty nice. Yeah, I felt better when I left IFMA and, you know, after doing this program. This is, they're taking blood samples from these patients, and so, you know, this is a biomarker of what happened in that intervention. And this was with, by the way, I should say, this was with an active control group. So they did a relaxation group. So they did a randomized trial of 60 women or so, put half in a relaxation group and half in a mindfulness-based stress reduction course. So interleukin 6 went down, and three others. The one I know about, I don't remember the other, well, the other two are up there, but, and sorry, I use this at the medical school. This is why all the p-values and everything are on there. But basically, natural killer cells increased. And again, those maintain. And you know, you don't need a scientific degree to know. It's probably good to have natural killer cells when you've got something like cancer. And actually, it's good when you even don't have them because they're destroying the free radicals in the body. Again, another A-level journal, and what they did here in this pain study, and this is Vago, David Vago's at Vanderbilt, but Fidel Zidane is at Wake Forest. And so what he did is give patients naloxone, which blocks the opioid receptors in the brain. But then what they found is that the patient's pain, their perception of pain and their actual pain signatures went down. So what's are you hearing this? So what's happening is that they're blocking the opioid receptors. So this is, so mindfulness is supporting some other pathway of reducing pain in the body. Now this is not to say that, oh, well now I just meditate because I teach at the VA. I mean, those veterans would throw me out a window if I came and just said, look, you don't need any kind of pain medication anymore or any surgery or anything. You know, but it is, what it says is this is a complementary alternative or an add-on to whatever else you're doing. Nutrition, they do aromatherapy, they do massage and yoga and all these different modalities. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but our VA has been ranked number one this year, and then like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, they won number one as well. So it's really a very progressive. I'm really proud to be part of that group. So yeah, so chronic pain. These studies have all been replicated in different ways, and so I just want to make sure I'm not like way behind. No, I'm pretty good. Okay, so the last one I'll talk about is something called working memory. You know, what is that? Who cares about working memory? Well, this is the capacity to manipulate information in short-term memory for short periods of time. So it's like, so think about driving to the mall. Right? Working memory is where you hold the directions. Attention says turn right at the next traffic light, right? But working memory says this is what I'm going to hold. It's what you value. And so this doesn't just apply to, this happened to be a cohort of special forces troops that they did this study with. And this is, again, this has been replicated with National Guard troops. It's been replicated with Division I college athletes. So it enhances, what I tell students at the schools where I teach is working memory is like your desktop, right? It's like where you keep, and if your desktop is this big, then you'll hold that much stuff there. But if it's this big, you'll be able to hold more capacity, you'll hold more things there. And this feeds and supports our ability to pay attention, like to focus and to accomplish, you know, tasks. And so they found that with 2 weeks of practice, they didn't get the same kind of growth in working memory. And they also found there's a dose effect. So that when we talk about how much practice to do, right, I've talked about practice being the linchpin, really critical. This is the research I'm standing on to say 8 to 10 minutes is the least amount of practice per day. And there's no data that supports whether you do it 4 minutes and four minutes at night or 4 minutes in the morning, all 8 minutes or 10 minutes at once, but just to do it. Right, so the possibilities. So I like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, you know. Our lives move incredibly fast. And so the invitation here is to actually be awake, to like tune in, to maybe tomorrow morning actually be with that cup of coffee or tea, you know, and whether you're at the, you know, black nothing in it, you know, and so, wow, I really taste the bitterness, you know, or you're at the super supreme latte filled whipped cream and all that jazz, whatever, but just, you know, to actually be there for it. You're there anyway. One of the medical students was telling me the other day that they call it their coffee practice, right? That they actually take their coffee and go back to bed for like 2 minutes. And for medical students, that's really saying something because their life is very hectic. And they say, I feel the warmth of it, like in my hand and inside of me. And I said, you know, that's resourcing. You know, I think mindfulness is a pretty cool gig. You know, I think it's a pretty neat thing to do and to practice and to integrate behaviorally in your life. But pick something. Like, pick something to resource yourself. Like, whether it's hiking or running or, you know, maybe cooking or gardening or whatever it is. Now, I think because mindfulness generalizes, right, you can apply it anywhere. It's durable. Firefighters use it in a burning building. I mean, they've reported this to me. So I think it has a lot of utility. It's low cost. It's long term. You can use it forever. But pick something. Like, pick something that is for you, you know, whether it's connection with others or whatever it is. So the possibilities are, this is from a smoking cessation program. This is treatment as usual. Or sorry, this is a relaxation control group, and this is mindfulness-based intervention. So you don't need to, again, you don't need to be a scientist to see that craving and usage but all dropped over. This was a two-week intervention. So is there science? Is that a possibility? Yes. I've hiked with all three of my daughters on the Appalachian Trail. So actually being out in nature might be your thing. Actually, how about actually being there instead of taking the committee meeting you were just at, you know, out on the walk with you. And so I missed the whole thing, perhaps. And then really being there with the people who need us, you know, at times. Somebody said, you know, to actually show up, you know, for a code blue or to be there with people when they need us most. So my invitation is to... if you don't have a kitchen timer, buy one, you know, like the phone is really tough to use as a timer. I mean, there are apps on it, and if that's what's supportive, great. That's awesome to use that. Anything that works. I like the sort of organic, analog feel to a kitchen timer. And they're only about $6. but if you can do it for 10 minutes, And there are recordings. There are I'll have my information, I think, at the end, or I can go back to the front screen. You're welcome to email me. There are lots of places. Insight Timer down below is a free timer. There are apps and so forth to use. But essentially, it's doing it. You know, it's walking to the mailbox and then walking down the street. And then going to a park and walking once around the track, it's starting small and then continuing, but actually doing it, getting out and doing it. The class I teach, and I have some postcards about this, is I start a new class at the end of this month, Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction at Mission Health. And I use the mountains and the sort of, I don't know if it's a river, but I'm treating it like a path, right, is that it is really a journey. It's a systematic and rigorous program. I tell people in audiences like this, 1 minute counts. At the fire department or the medical school or the VA or wherever, 1 minute counts. And it does, because just taking a minute could mean the difference between reacting and regretting something you do as opposed to responding. In that course, I'll tell you that the invitation is to do the practices 30 to 45 minutes. And look, I know life shows up. There are plenty of people who go through the class and have to miss a week or 2 weeks or whatever of practice. But just know that this is structure. You know, if structure is something that helps you, that's great, because behavior change is really challenging. I don't know if you've tried to really change a behavior lately, but willpower is usually not quite enough, because it's so subjective to fatigue and loneliness and busyness and all these sort of vicissitudes of life. So having a structure, having a group of people who are making this journey with you can be helpful. There's books and articles, and as I mentioned, the Headspace Timer. So this practice is really a practice and then an application, right? Applying mindfulness. So it's not just sitting with your eyes closed. It's actually, you can be mindful and hopefully are at times or most of the time driving. And it is really about the application, right? It's not about becoming some Olympic meditator. I mean, honestly, if it didn't have pragmatic utility in my life, I would have dropped it 10 minutes after I started. But it does, and it has it really quickly. What kind of questions do you have? Yes, ma'am.
In this kind of mindfulness that you're teaching, I'm curious about the role of sensation. Mm-hmm. Connecting the sensation, is that a piece of it?
Absolutely.
And then you're talking about connecting the internal, external sensation.
Like sound?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure. So it's one of the primary domains of paying attention is the body. And we're giantly out of touch with the body. And so we can bring our awareness to any aspect of our lives. And so in MBSR, the class, we start with the body, something called a body scan. Right? So you're beginning to tune into what is even happening inside, and to know that it's one of those other areas of a gentle glide path, because a lot of us have an enormous amount of stress in the body or even trauma. And so to know it's not something where you have to force this to be connected into your experience, but to begin to taper that connection into your own body in the service of actually tuning in. Because the body is not just carrying us out in the world, it's informing us about the world. Like, it's giving us a lot of data about what is happening, and if we're suppressing that or numbing it out, then we're missing a lot. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that's certainly a foundation. Yes, Harriet.
In my personal life, as much as in my work with people, it seems like there's sometimes a delay between deciding that mindfulness meditation or mindfulness practice is a good idea and then being able to do it consistently. Mm-hmm. What have you found in your teaching or in your own practice that helps you get anchored in the intent of the practice?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think using dopamine instead of willpower, right? So finding the places where it's supportive, like dopamine is that, you know, the feel good, you know, kind of one of them, you know, is oxytocin and serotonin and so forth. But I think that is, I think, you know, as opposed to, I mean, for my practice, like, it's pretty regular, you know, but I think finding places where, you know, I do experience something positive, you know, even in the practice itself, like I can feel really agitated or stirred up about something, got a big talk later today or something, and sit down in the practice, not with the goal of getting rid of anything, but just saying, let me just be here and sit with this, and inevitably, like, things settle, you know, things begin to calm. And so to tune into that, I think, can be really helpful. And that's why you look for those early first wins, you know, where you're just trying it a little bit, like that cup of coffee, you know, and saying, let me actually tune into this. And you're like, wow, you know, I wasn't aware that I actually hate coffee. I think I want tea. You know, I had a woman who said, I thought I loved cashews. She said, I hate cashews. Like, I used to eat them by the handful. She says, no, I love pistachios. Like, well, okay. But yeah, so that's one. And then I think, you know, there are lots of different ways to connect. And I think scaffold, like structure, I think can be really helpful. Like just, you know, getting it on your calendar and not making the decision that morning, you know, say, oh, am I going to just have it in there, like put it as a placeholder in the calendar. Those basic behavioral things. But I think one other one I'll just say is if we can draft off of a current behavior, right? If we can draft off the behavioral momentum of something else, and what I use with a lot of the groups I work with is the car. So when you get to a place, anybody drive on I-26? That's pretty fun. Like, that's roulette, right? Like, what's it going to be like? You know, we were coming here from down south, and it's like, man, do we need to leave like an hour ahead, or can we leave in 20 minutes? And so taking that, you know, that found minute that you didn't sit in traffic, you know, coming on Merriman or, you know, coming on 26 or something, when you get to your destination and saying, actually, let me just take the dividend of that minute and just sit here for and just arrive, right? So drafting off those other behaviors that we already have can be really helpful. Right. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Didn't see it.
So, if part of mindfulness is to be present in the present, how does mindfulness process, heal, release the past, and how does mindfulness prepare, dream for the future?
Yeah. So, I would say, in terms of engaging with the past, I think it sets the foundation, the platform, and what happens first is stabilizing that platform, right? So utilizing the body, perhaps sound, using anything really can work, can be that focus, the anchor, right? And so what we want to do is find something that becomes useful to center attention, to stabilize attention. And from there, then you might begin to just simply slowly check in what's happening in the body, what's happening in the mind. And this isn't like, and we don't do, you know, MBSR is not some kind of clinical program. It's not group therapy, but what happens is things come up, right? Naturally, just by stilling the body somewhat, things are going to start coming up. And so to know that there is a gentleness in how you meet those. And so something might come up from the past, and what you say is, I'm going to go have a drink of water. Like, what I need to do to take care of myself, what I need to stay grounded is to, like, go for a walk. And so that can be really skillful. What isn't so skillful is saying, well, I'm going to, you know, wrench down and tighten up the bolts, you know, to deal with something that's happened in the past. It's sort of as if you're coming at what's gone on in a way that is more gentle, right? So the mind is going to secrete all these thoughts about the past, about the future. And so what we're doing is actually stabilizing attention, building some equanimity in the present, and then just watching, because things will come, right? And so it's a matter of managing, you know, what comes up at the time. And then there are lots of different ways to work with those, and we teach a couple of them in the class, but it's a matter of building that stable foundation first. And that works with the future as well. Like, just noticing like where the mind goes, how quickly it goes to the past and future. Okay, so it's, yeah, stable. Yep. And then I know we're getting after time. I'm happy to stay for a little bit, so but maybe let's do one more, and then if you need to go, just please feel free to go ahead and head out.
I've heard there's some studies that talk about the influence of mindfulness and the effect on like DNA and breaking down as telomeres, is the right word?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Telomeres.
Are you familiar with these studies? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's a researcher out of UC Berkeley, a woman, she actually won the Nobel Prize not for her work on telomeres, but she's been on those studies. There was another one I just read yesterday in psychoneuroimmunology. And actually, what they found, so they did three groups. One was a relaxation group, one was a mindfulness meditation group, and the other was a loving kindness meditation group. Both the two meditation groups reduced, or actually helped sustain telomere length, or actually increase some telomere length. But actually, loving kindness meditation, which we didn't get into, but it is part of the course, and actually had the most impact. And this was over, I think, a 12-week intervention. But yeah, the research is astounding, what is out there, what the mind is capable of, doing. And just to say, without the hype, what happens for you, right? I mean, somebody may come into the class to say, wow, the brain research looks good, I'm worried about dementia, or I'm worried about, keeping my cognitive function or something, or... I'm losing it at home, too emotionally at times. And so to just come in and check it out, like not come in with some giant expectation that this has to work for this, but see what happens. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.